fish number 11363, reel 4.
And that, I was ashore in the shore base for a spell, and they drafted me to this bunkering ship, Westcliff Hall, by, I forget now, Constantine's. Samuel Veeley was Constantine's. I forget who I managed that. Anyway, one of the coal firms. And the captain was a Captain McLaren, and he was, I should say, he must have been retired, or he was certainly due retire. He was a real gent, he was, the old captain. And if you looked at him, you see, you know, these old photos of the old sailing ship skippers with a little, sort of little pillbox, very small peak. He used to wear a cap like that. And you'd take, you know, he could pass himself off as an old sailing shipman. He was a real gent, he was. And his wife used to come and stay with him times, for 4 weeks on him. And we used to bunker all the auxiliaries, because there were quite a few coal burners in on the Clyde there, like trawlers, drifters, steam drifters, you know, steam trawlers. And the boom defence, all the boom defence vessels were coal burners. And we'd go up to, I think it was Rosyth Dock. It was near John Brown's yard, up on the Clyde. We'd go up there, it's 24 miles up from Greenock.
Rosyth's on the other side, isn't it, of Scotland?
Well, I think it was Rosyth Dock. I don't know whether that was the proper... But they used to say Rossy Dock. It's shortened to Rossy Dock.
Rossy, yes.
Yes, it's Rossy Dock.
Rossy, yeah, on the...
It's near John...
I think it's on the Isle of
Bute. Ah, well, this dock was called something.
Rossy, like, yeah.
I don't know. But you could see John Brown's yard. On the other side of the river, you could see where they cut out for the Mary to be launched. You know, they cut the riverbank out, didn't they? Well, we used to go there about every 6 weeks to load up, see... Load up coal under the hoist, bring it down and anchor off between Gurock and just the nearest place was Kilcreggan. That's on the Clyde. And it was a weekly boat, and we all had our own ration books. We had a civilian ration book, but a merchant navy ration book actually, but it was the same as civilian, but you got more. Extra rations, Merchant Navy did, more than the civilian ration. But you bought your own food, and the Navy allowed you 3 and 6 a day. You could buy your own food and cook your own food, the same as the cooks, the same as the crew. But in this case, you could opt for, if the cook was, or the steward, was agreeable, you could mess in with the crew, you see, with the officers, which we did in this case. And the steward, the cook, well, it was cook and steward, he had our ration books, and got all our rations, and cooked all our food and everything. And we were allowed 3 and 6 a day. That was paid directly into the shipping company, that 3 and 6 a day, for, you know, subsistence. At the end of the day, you can see the cost of living in those days. The captain was very good. We'd get a small rebate sort of thing at the end of the month. He used to pay, but we'd get some back. 3 and 6 a day. And that's that. And every other day, the cook would need to go ashore for fresh veggies and stuff. And we'd row, take the boat, I used to go with him, and we'd row the boat, no motorboats. There was a luxury on earth, you know. roundabout to Kilcreggan. There was a little country store there. There was an off license as well, and post office in general. And they'd get for it all he needs there. So we had some hairy crossings as well, coming back. We're blowing off a gale. It was very rough up in the Clyde there in the winter time. And the ferry used to cross from Gourock to Kilcreggan. It was a small ferry, passenger ferry. And there were lots of ships anchored in the Clyde. It would call around the ships, picking up people, if anybody wanted to be picked up to go ashore and take people back. One incident, the Empress of Scotland, yeah, it was the Empress of Scotland was in, and I was on the ferry, and I don't know who he was, but he got a Gladstone bag, and he wanted to get off, he wanted the Empress of Scotland. Well, to get on board, you got to go up a Jacob's ladder right beside. So he puts this Gladstone bag, pretty heavy, he puts it up on the top of the cabin of the boat. And with the idea of throwing a heaving line down, and, you know, when he gets up and... So he's just running up the ladder. So the boatman didn't realise he left his bag on the top. So he moves away. And this chap's up on top by then, and he's shouting, tearing his hair out, and he's going, mad. Come back here, so, you know. And they drew the ferryman's attention. And he did a U-turn, you see. But as he turned, it just heeled over slightly. The bag slipped off the top, went into, he sank like a stone. What was it? I don't know. But whatever it was, he wasn't very pleased, but because he stood there, he couldn't do nothing about it, he could see it all happening, you know, it must have been frustrating. But that was just a little incident.
So you did a transatlantic voyage in this steamer, did you?
No, it never went anywhere, you see, it just bunkered there.
Yeah. Would it have been capable of going to sea?
Oh, I think it would have ended up on the invasion after, the invasion of Normandy, you see. It had made the Atlantic crossing during the war because it's from the Great Lakes, you see. It brought it over from Canada or the States or whatever. Oh, right, it had come up there from there originally built on the Clyde somewhere, but it had gone out built for the Great Lakes, you see, and that was a coal burner.
But yeah. You never went to sea in it?
No, it was just to go up the Clyde. To the dock, to load coal, you see, and it would stop there, stay there in a bunker.
But you eventually, in 1944, got to North America again.
Yeah, I was fed up with, you know, being stuck there, you know, not very pleasant, you know, we got fed up with. And there's a shore base in... Greenock. It was HMS Carrick. It's an old sailing ship. I see recently they've got plans now to restore it. It's about the same vintage as the Cutty Sark. It's an old wooden sailing ship. And I went to used to go there about every fortnight for wages to get paid there. And I would ask, you know, every time I went, any chance I could win off this, you know. No. So I said, one week, I said, if I volunteer for foreign service, would they get me? Oh, yes, sure, you volunteer for foreign service, you'll get you. So I was put down for foreign service. It's the only way I could get off. So I got off, and I left. There was four of us. He came to us one day and said, week's leave for you four, and you're on draft. So we had a week's leave, and we were back a few days, and he came. The four of you, Liverpool. Catch the train tonight, six something from Greenock. So So the four of us went down and they met us at Lime Street. Travelled overnight and met us at Lime Street. And we went, we joined the Andes, which was at Prince's London Stage. This is almost brand new, it's unfinished, just as the war broke out. Never finished as a passenger boat. It went straight into Trooping and it was finished. And we went across to Halifax from there.
Again, not encountering the enemy?
No, it went on its own. It was a fact, I should think it'd do about 20, that would, easily. It was a fast ship. And we went in the Canadian dockyard there at Halifax. We were there about a fortnight. And we were drafted over to Victoria on Vancouver Island. We went by train. The chap with our draft, well, he'd gone over with us on the Andes. He got a sister in Victoria. He wasn't on the draft, but he was talking to a chap that was on the draft, and he swapped drafts. And he was able to go and see his sister. He hadn't seen her for 17 years. He'd been out there 17 years, he hadn't seen her.
What was the idea of crossing Canada to Victoria?
Well, they were building ships in Vancouver and Victoria. They're building new ships for the British and for the Canadian Merchant Navy. The fort, all the British, such as the one I was on a fort, Fort Norman, Fort whatever, you know, all began with Fort. The Canadians, the ships that went over to the Canadian Merchant, they ended in Park, whatever, some so-and-so Park, you know. They all prefixed Park or Fort, Fort British and Park, but they're all the same ships. They were built the same size as the Liberties, but they were not turned out so quick, you know, they weren't geared up like the Americans were. They hadn't got the resources that the Americans had got. But they, we went out to pick up these new four ships. We were in a place called Esquimalt, the big Canadian Navy base there. We were in the Canadian base just the same as, you know, billeted the same as the Canadian. And we waited there, it must be 3 months or 4 months. In the meantime, the European war had ended. That had finished. But, of course, the Japanese war was still on. So, we were the last, the five of us left. All the others were drafted onto new ship. Because there was just five of us left, we were drafted. So we didn't get in a new ship, we got an old one. Belonged to W&R Carpenter, the London based firm, or well, Sydney and London. They traded around the islands in Australia.
The Pacific Islands?
Yeah, around the Pacific Islands. So we joined the ship.
What was it called?
The Lansing, L-A-N-C-I-N-G, Lansing. It was built in 1998, and it looked it as well, it looked its age. It was in a terrible, shocking state it was. It was absolutely just rotting away, you know. So we joined it, it was loading, the day we went, they dropped our bag on the quayside there, we looked up and it was pouring down with rain, one of these days, you know. And it was a horrible looking, filthy looking thing. It was the most depressing it was. When we got on board, I couldn't stand upright on below deck. Yeah, in most places, because the deck edge was so low.
How tall are you?
I'm not quite 6 foot. Most places, you'd walking on it. It was very old. They say 1898, and no, I wouldn't be surprised. And We went on board, and it was an Australian steward. The steward was Australian. The first chap we got into contact with was the steward. And he was a decent chap, the steward. He gave us a bit of gen on what was going on. And there were a Fiji crew, all white officers. There was a Canadian engineer, a Scots mate, an English, Australian Englishman, you know, I think he'd gone out there to live, an Englishman had gone out to Australia, but he was classed himself as an Australian, captain, a Scots, as I say, Scots mate, I don't know what the second mate was, the Canadian engineer, one or two Australian steward, and all the rest were Fiji, the officers were white, and the Fijian and Solomon Island crew and firemen. But it's an oil burner, one to coal. And the second day we were on, the crew went on strike. All the native crew went on strike and walked off.
Why was that?
Because the captain had said something to one of them. He called him a black bastard. Because it was over a trivial thing, and he called him a black bastard, and they walked off. Well, whether the Canadians had trouble with the ship before, or I don't know, but of course the immigration people had got all the trouble with the crew, having to find accommodation and that sort. So they said, the crew said they would not sail with the captain. So after a few days, I forget now just exactly how long it was, but after a few days, the authorities said, supposed to give them an ultimatum, and said, well, the captain, if it's a choice of the crew or the captain, they should have to be the captain. So they took the captain, and the captain came off anyway. He was relieved. Well, he wasn't relieved. The mate took his job. The mate moved up one, and the captain was taken off. And all the crew went back. So they finished loading them, mostly lumber, you know, timber. And then we went round to a place called Port Alberni on Vancouver Island, and finished loading lumber there on deck cargo. And we started off then down to San Francisco. And we loaded Duck W's, you know, these amphibious jeeps, up on top of the on top of the deck cargo.
They were called W's, were they?
Duck W's, D-U-K-W. They were amphibious jeep. And there we went down to Suva in the Fijis. And I think they took the Duck W's off in Suva, I'm not sure. And from Suva, of course the Fijians were happy as sandboys, they were back home. But the Crafty Shipping Company, they took the captain off. The captain came back on at Suva, and they changed the crew. They took all the Fijians off and replaced them with another crew.
Because of their strike action?
Yeah. They swapped. And so the captain resumed his normal course. But he was a pig, the captain was. He was a real pig.
In what way?
He could no respect for nobody, and he treated everybody like dirt. He was a horrible man. He fancied himself, you know, he was a tall fella, and he got always a uniform. I think he fancied himself as an admiral or something. Or he got ideas.
How did but he treat you?
Not very good. I had a few brushes with him.
Over what?
Well, the first thing, you know, we used to come back, we'd had a few drinks, perhaps singing, you know, singing at the top of your voice, and things like that. things like that. No, never any fights or any bother. Never nothing violent. It was just high spirits. And he didn't like you mixing with the crew. The crew, they were very friendly people. And we got an old gramophone. Well, to them, a gramophone was, it was a marvellous thing. And we'd only got about three records. And the one record we got was a Maori duet, a duo, sang by a Maori couple. And it was more in their style of music, you know, being Maori. And we'd play the record for them, and they'd sit there, they were just no bother at all. And the captain didn't approve of that, mixing with the natives, with the crew. And I mean, we never thought nothing about it, but to him, it was, you know, he didn't approve of it at all. You shouldn't mix with the crew. Shouldn't mix with the crew. And we were just a nuisance to him. He didn't approve of, you know, our action. And the least little thing he could pick on. Like, there was one instance where they were ashore with a mate, the Scots fella. Two of the lads went ashore with him, and he was telling them, "You're entitled to a bottle of beer a day," he says. Well, I came back and with all this full of this idea about that they'd entitled a bottle of beer. So they convinced me, you know, like a damn fool. I went up to the shore and I said, "We're entitled to a bottle of beer today." And the steward, the other steward had left in the meantime, and he's been replaced by this fresh steward, who was an ex-customs man. Well, you know, the customs men, they don't miss a trick, do they? They know all the ropes. And he was a bit of a bite in it, he was. You know, it was a bit hard to get up with. So I went up to him, and I said, "We're entitled to a bottle of beer today." You know, the mate said, "You're not, you know." So an argument ensued about this. I said, "All right, then we'll go up in front of the captain. I'll take you up to the captain and see what he says." So we went up to the captain, and the captain said, "What's this?" I said, "The mate said that we're entitled to a bottle of beer today." "Fetch the mate," he said to the steward. So I fetched the mate came up the ladder. "What's this you've been telling these lads? This is a bottle of beer today." And he looked him straight in the eye, the mate. He says, I never said no such thing. You know, of course that was a black mark. And when he came to the end of the voyage, when he came to fill in my report, it was not very good. You know, we just didn't see eye to eye at all. But it was... I'm harbouring the story a bit. Somewhat.
What was the status of Dems gunners on these merchant ships? Did you...
Well, for the most part...
Were you kind of race apart, or...?
Well, yeah, most ships, you mixed with the... You know, it was a good mix, really. We were accepted. And some captains... you never see the captain, never spoke to him, you know. But for the crew, you mostly, you got on all right, generally, yes. With the crew, yeah. But on the Lansing, the Canadian engineer, he got a, by the way, he got a surgical boot, you know. He could, the sole of his boot was jacked up about that much. And he worked down the engine room. You know, that's a thing I could never understand. And there was another steward. Another Australian joined the ship when we got. And we used to go ashore together, go to pubs and whatever, you know. Mix. But we went from Silver down to Brisbane. And finished discharging. Then we went down to Sydney. While we were in Sydney, there's some trouble with the engine. some trouble in the engine room, and we were 6 weeks there. Such an old tub, I suppose, and getting the bits and pieces for it. It took 6 weeks to put the repairs in order. And in the meantime, we'd got this new steward on, this ex-customs. And then we went back to Suva. Well, one of the, I forget who it was now, he said, when we go to Tonga, we were going to Tonga. It varied. Sometimes it got to Tahiti. Sometimes it would depend where the cargo was. But then on this occasion, they were going to Tonga. The captain will ask you to do the tallying. He always has the gunners to do it. And it's a shilling an hour. Said 1 shilling per hour. That's for tallying the cargo. That's just counting the, and they come up on the slings, count down their bags, put it down. And government, I think it was a government supervision, the other part of it, the export of the copra. I think they were government civil servants, the tallymen were. And he tallied for the Tonga people. So the two of you tally, and you tally for the company, and they tally for the... So, you see, nobody cheated. None of it mattered to us whether they cheated or not. So he said, he'll offer you a shilling an hour, you see. So I said to the leading seaman, the charge, I said, well, I'm not working for a shilling an hour. I said, you tell him, when if he does come, you know, offer this the job, we want $0.50 Canadian. And when you get back to Canada, it'll be worth so much. You know, half a day, you can spend some, you know, it's worth spending in Canada. So they all backed me up, you see. So he comes down into the mess. The only time he ever went down into the mess. And I was out at the time. And he said about this, oh, no, this is going to be, oh, well, see, it was below the officer's dignity to do the tallying, you see. I mean, it was unheard of for the officer to be tallying. Especially in a port with us all natives. And they couldn't trust any other native crew to do it, see, or they wouldn't, you know, whether they couldn't or whether they wouldn't, I don't know. So he said, yes, okay, $0.50. So we used to do a 12-hour shift, tallying, and I did night, I chose night. I used to do 8 till 8 in the morning, 12 hours. So I would be $6 better off every shift, which is good money, you know, which would be perhaps a week's wages almost for me in those days. So we tallied, and it all came on board in bags, and they tipped it down into the holes, out of the bags, loose. First place we started loading was Nuku'alofa, where the Queen of Tonga's palace was. You could see the palace from where we were, a little jetty. And it was from the jetty, or from the ship, you could see the palace. And we had a week there loading there, and then we went to a place called Hai Pai. Now we loaded off a beach there. They brought it out in lighters. They beached the lighters on the beach and loaded them off lorries, and then brought the lighters out when the tide was right, brought them out, floated them alongside the ship, then winched them out the ship, down the barges. And we ended up finished loading Wellpile, a place called Vavau. That was alongside, you know, like a little lagoon sort of.